Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
Welcome back, Cracked fans, to another edition of the Cracked Interviews podcast. I'm your host, Alex Gruskin. Again, to any fans out there who thinks the tennis world stops after the majors are done, you're just wrong. There's so much tennis left to be played. A huge event, Laver Cup, I believe that starts next weekend. We're going to do a bunch of coverage about that then. Also, a bunch of challengers throughout the world, 125Ks here and there. So still plenty of things to talk about, but with there being a bit of a break, we also get the chance to do some really fun stuff, and that is why I am so thrilled to bring on today's guest. If you are a listener of this pod, you are likely a fan of all things tennis social media, and you will recognize our guest's voice today from all of the work she does. The proprietor of one of, in my opinion, the funniest tennis media videos, Cam Norrie in Houston, working through all the college tennis symbols earlier this year. You'll recognize her for all of the sideline interviews she does post-match as well at the U.S. Open, at Cincinnati, at the Rogers Cup. And you may not know, she's also a former Rice tennis superstar, Arthur Ashe Award leader for leadership, Conference USA Player of the Year, multiple-time ITA scholar athlete. Blair Henley, welcome to the Cracked Interview Podcast.
Alex, thank you for reminding me of all of those things that have long since been forgotten in my career. I appreciate it.
Oh, in the run-up for this, I want you to know I watched a lot of your instructional videos, and that one-handed backhand is gorgeous.
Well, thank you very much. I will take that. It's becoming less gorgeous by the day, but at least that video exists online to preserve it in my memory.
We had the chance to talk to someone I know you know well, Nick McCarville, earlier in the week. He said you guys were filming on Arthur Ashe and got to hit a little bit there. Did you get to play on Ashe as well?
I missed that, and I have told Nick that I am still jealous and will continue to be jealous for the rest of my career. Hopefully, there's still time. Who knows? Maybe I'll get to see at some point. I was not part of that particular shoot, though. So Nick, he got to experience that, and I am forever jealous.
Be honest, you and Nick play a set right now. You're feeling confident, right?
I'm going to go ahead and say I am feeling confident, but, you know, these days, I will say I try to play as much as I can. I don't get to play as much as I would like to, but, you know, that's one thing. Nick and I have done a lot together. We have never actually played tennis against each other, so perhaps we should make it happen.
Oh, absolutely. We can do a little crossover, Cracked Rackets versus U.S. Open Now crew, a battle, you and Nick versus me and Max. We'll see who wins. The place I want to start, I mentioned Nick and obviously the streak you've had from Rogers Cup to Cincinnati to the U.S. Open. Just how are you feeling now that we're done with the year's final major?
I will tell you, always takes me a few days to kind of get back to normal life. All the emails, there are texts. I usually, after the U.S. Open, will just scroll back through my texts weeks back, because I know there have been people who have texted me who I have either not seen or ignored or forgotten about, all the emails that I've missed. It's, you know, all the bills that I haven't paid. So it's really just like getting back into the swing of real life. It always takes me a few days to kind of get come out of the sleep deficit. But again, a lot of great memories from this year as well.
There have to have been at least like six text messages at the bottom that were like, "Hey Blair, it's X from college. Any chance you can get me U.S. Open tickets?"
I have actually posted this on social media. I think at one point, Chris Evert actually posted it. She said, "Listen, people ask me for U.S. Open tickets. It's the hardest slam of the year to get tickets to." I mean, I have never been successful in getting anyone a ticket to the U.S. Open. So it has not worked out well for those people who text me every year. I really do think they are saying, "Oh gosh, she's just trying to get out of this." But it really is so incredibly difficult to get anyone into the U.S. Open.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Like, applying for a press pass is literally asking for access to Fort Knox. They're like, well, you know, have you been paid before? Who paid you? Is it a reputable person who paid you? It's all of these, it's like the littlest details. It's half the fun of the Open. But I have to ask, of the 2 weeks, you know, so many great storylines, your favorite part of covering the event?
Ooh, I think there were just a lot of feel-good stories. I happen to have a few of them on my court, really from the first round when Juan Ignacio Londero beat Sam Querrey, which on paper probably shouldn't have happened. And Juan Ignacio, if you are new to him, he gave a very charming post-match, and if you were next to me, I would be using air quotes, interview, because I asked.
It was like six words, I believe. I've seen that.
I'll paraphrase. It was, hello, congratulations to Sam. I'm very happy. Goodbye. And there was a murmur. People were wondering, okay, is he done? And then when they realized that he was done, people broke out into this massive applause. It ended up being such a charming moment. And I actually tweeted about that. Usually if players aren't strong on the English front, they will tell me in advance and I will kind of tailor the interview accordingly. He said nothing of the sort. He just went in. He knew he was going to say exactly what he wanted to say no matter what my question to him was, and it worked out, and his interview got a lot of play on social media, and I think a lot of people who may not have known him before ended up knowing him after that. So that things started off on a fun note for me on grandstand. Christiane also won her third round match on grandstand as well. Absolutely packed house for that. And it was right after Ben Rothenberg's story on her had come out in the New York Times. And if you didn't get a chance to read it, I would encourage you to Google it to find it, because it was just talking about how after she played at Stanford, her parents agreed to fund 3 years of professional tennis for her, and that ended, I think, in 2017. And at that point, I think she kind of described it as her parents looking at her and saying, okay, where's the real job? Where's the normal job? And she said, listen, I didn't want to have any regrets, and then has this incredible breakout run at the U.S. Open. So that happened in front of a packed house on grandstand. There were tears. I had chills, which is unusual for me. Normally, I'm kind of in the zone, and so I don't maybe experience those emotional moments like I would if I were a fan, but totally had chills in that moment. So that was a lot of fun. Grigor Dimitrov had a big win over Alex de Minaur on grandstand, referenced Backstreet Boys, what could be better. So there were just a lot of, for me, a lot of really great stories. Dominic Koepfer was another one who I believe made more at the U.S. Open than he had in his entire career in his 25 years, which again is a game changer for a player like that. So it was a lot of fun to kind of see some of those moments in real time.
We have a lot of sideline highlights from yours over the years that I want to get to, but just in general for our listeners, because the post-match interview is such a rare insight into the player's mind, right? You're talking to them right after the match finishes. You know, for them, the emotions are still raw, they're sweaty, they're, you know, out of breath. And so I'm curious for you, how do you, you know, massage the two things of getting a good answer out of them without throwing an overwhelming question their way?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I think I'm probably still figuring it out. But I do put a lot of thought into the way I ask certain things, even if the question itself is basic. I try to maybe phrase it in a way that would, I don't know, maybe make them open up in a way that they haven't before. Again, it's not always rocket science. Sometimes you're just going to get those very basic answers that sometimes you tend to get from athletes. But you really never know. And for me, I think there's also the inner battle of the journalism side of things. I know out there I'm not a cut and dry journalist. I am in some ways a spokesperson for the tournament. I want to make the player look as good as possible. But if there is an elephant in the room, for instance, for you, with Aryna Sabalenka and Elise Bruce,
I was about to get there, exactly.
It was a perfect example of this, because I sit in my little green room and I think to myself, okay, do we want to go there? Do I feel like I can go there without a player being uncomfortable in the background? For those who may not have followed it, is she split with her coach, Dmitry Tursunov, during the tournament. and then put kind of all of her thoughts, feelings, and emotions out there in an Instagram post, essentially saying, we fight like a married couple, but we are really good for each other. You'd have to go back and find it. And then he ended up being in her box for that double semifinal with Elise Burton, which of course they won. And Arena, I think you have to, again, this is where it helps in my case to have relationships with these players. And a lot of them I've interviewed before, and you kind of know how they handle things out there. And she has such an incredible attitude. She's very open. She's very honest with her emotions. And I thought that, you know, I wasn't going to say, hey, we all read the Instagram post, but I thought it was in that moment worth mentioning that he was there, and why is that special for him to be in the stands for her? And she gave a great answer. It was self-deprecating. She's like, yes, she did that work for me. She said, I think everyone saw the Instagram post. So again, I think you just kind of have to read that situation. And if I can, I also try to make sure I know what's going on in the player's life, whether it's something they posted on social media or an article that's come out about them. I definitely try to be well-read, because you never know when you could get a good little nugget where kind of my third question I try to make kind of more on the fun side, more on the human interest side. And so if I can ask a question that is going to show off a player's personality, where maybe a fan in the stands who's never seen X, Y, or Z player can hear that and say, oh, hey, that's interesting. He likes golf, or, you know, she hates ice baths, or, you know, that little thing that a fan can grab onto that can make them remember that player next time around. That's when I feel like I'm doing my job.
I asked Sloane Stephens during the Cincinnati press day, I was fortunate enough to be there, about her chocolate milk sponsorship, and I swear that was like the most fun she had answering a question. So yeah, you have to throw in the fun ones, right? And speaking of fun ones, this is a little off topic from the U.S. Open, but to find out, because in the Cincinnati press room, there were a bunch of funky answers, right? Pringles Gate emerged there. We find out later that it's all a Jimmy Fallon skit. In the moment, were you in the loop? Are you, you know, one of the people that are like, hey, when Madison Keys is like all sack in the kayak or whatever it was, and all of these different answers, are you in the loop there? Or were you thinking like, this doesn't seem right?
I did happen to be in the loop. I know. I will say, though, I would have had loads of, if I weren't in the loop, I would have been put on my detective hat and tried to figure out what the heck was going on, because it was definitely a little fishy. But I did happen to know what was going on behind the scenes, my role there for Cincinnati, because actually the video team was editing some of that content that came in for late night. So again, there were very few people who knew, but it was funny to see the reactions in real time.
Yeah, I mean, when Osaka comes into the room and says, hey, do you want to hear a joke? I was like, something's not right. Like, this, something's up. I need to know. I'm doing some investigating. I'm about to crack a story. Of course, it was just a Fallon skit. But, you know, you talked about using, you know, reading a player and being able to be personable, but still be able to get real answers from them. But you use the phrase, you know, you want to get a little nugget of entertainment to connect them with the fan. Well, I can think of no better incident of you getting not just a little nugget, but you're getting the full 20-piece McNugget from McDonald's than when you went to Dennis Shapovalov, you read his face, and you said, Dennis, I think you can rap right now. One of the all-time tennis Twitter, tennis social media blow-up moments. Just take us through the play-by-play, please.
Okay. Well, first of all, let me say huge props to Dennis, because this story, I think, because a lot of people only saw that moment where he actually rapped. Well, his prior match on my court, he had just beat Steve Johnson, I believe, maybe the second or third round. And all the days kind of blend together when I'm at a tournament. But I believe he had just beaten Stevie Johnson. And it was right at the height of of Dennis's, he was blogging, he was rapping, he was doing lots of things on social media. And my third question for him, my human interest fun question for him after that match was, you know, you've shown us that not only are you good at tennis, but you're also good at rapping. And I am not kidding, he turned 8 shades of purple. I was not planning on asking him to rap, but the crowd went wild, and I actually thought he might rap then and there. And but then he said to me, you know, no, I can't do it. Oh man, I'm tight. I can't. And I said, no, don't worry. I was not going to ask you to rap. But you know, talk about how much fun it is to kind of have this interest in this hobby outside of tennis. He gave a great answer about that. And because I sensed that there was part of him that really did want to break out into a rap at that moment, I said, here's the deal, Dennis, before you leave us here on Stadium 3, if you end up back on this court and if you win another match here, will you rap for us? Crowd goes wild. He says, yes, absolutely. Well, who would have thought 2 days later, Order of Play comes out and the Shapovalov is on my court again. And I believe it was Marin Cilic. So again, certainly not an easy match for him at all. So again, I'm thinking, you know, even if he's game, he may not win. Who knows? And so going into that match, I'm up in the booth with my producer, who, as she should be, is very much a rule follower. We have very strict guidelines of what music we can play up there. But I'm like, we need to have a beat ready. Just in case he decides he wants to do this. So imagine me, you've never met me in person, but I am not a rap connoisseur, but I am on YouTube looking for like clean, basic rap track or rap beat, you know, no. And I'm, you know, paranoid because I'm thinking, oh gosh, you know, I have to listen to the whole 40 minutes because if there's one, you know, obscenity, you know, we could all get fired. So anyway, all of these things are happening in the production booth. He plays a fantastic match, and so my producer's ready in the booth. She's sweating bullets because she thinks she's going to, who knows what could happen. And I get to him for the post-match interview, and I said, are you ready? He said, oh man. He said, I'm tight. I'm feeling tight. But he was clearly he knew what I was talking about, and he was clearly ready, and he did not say no. And because, of course, a player, at any point, if a player is not comfortable, they have carte blanche to say to me. And I had enough, I've interviewed Dennis enough times before that he certainly could have said, no way, or can't do it. But he did not say that. And so we got to our third question. First two questions were normal. Third question was, all right, Dennis, anyone who was up here a couple days ago knows. We made a deal. and then I come to find out, not only is he prepared to rap, he has prepared a rap for this moment. And so anyway, we get the beat going. So we have rap music on Stadium 3 in Indian Wells. Everybody is so invested. Everybody in the stadium stayed. So packed house. He tries the first time, doesn't quite happen. Tries the second time, doesn't quite happen. Goes to grab his phone. That's when I realized, wow, he actually like wrote something for this. So he grabs his phone, gets the lyrics, nails it. And I have actually a picture somebody took. Because again, in case this happened, I was like, well, I need to have photographic proof. So I had somebody who was there who was ready just in case. He took a picture. It was at both of us with his team in the background. And his mom is videoing. His coach at the time, Rob Steckley, has like both arms up in the air. It's like this moment of triumph after he nails the rap on. I mean, the crowd goes wild. It was such a pure, fun moment that you obviously rarely see on a tennis court. The fans, I guarantee you, any fan who saw that live is a Denis Shapovalov fan for life. And I love when players will show us maybe a little bit of their personality that we don't always get to see. I think that is fantastic. And I say all of this because, as you all know, breaking news, social media was not as kind. it was so great for the people who were there, and it was a rough reaction online, which made me so sad because I'm working still so proud of that moment because that's guts to do. And he did it, and I made me so sad that people, you know, that social media did its thing and was not as positive. But again, I think it was endearing overall. It was a wild experience from start to finish. That was a much longer story probably than you bargained for there. But that is the Denis Shapovalov rap story.
You say you are just a tournament promoter. That was some good f***ing journalism. I don't know what you're talking about. To get him to rap, that was one of the – I mean – Was it a good? I'm not going to criticize the rap. It was awesome. Everything about it was. It's what you want. Yeah, no, you deserve some credit as well for holding him to it, being like, we're doing this, Dennis. It was a full team commitment. As you said, you could have been fired.
You know what? Things could have gone south, but thankfully, I hope it's something that people will look back on fondly, including Dennis at some point. He may not look back on it fondly at this point in his life, but I hope at one point in his life he does.
No, the best part is now he'll definitely have to do it again because that's not the one he wants to go out on. But with that in mind, you talk about, you know, all there's so many young, talented players, a lot of whom seem to be coming through your courts. How do you massage, knowing with the rise in tennis social media, obviously that component of it, not only do players, you know, they have platforms now to just, you know, produce content themselves, but tournaments, all the amount of content being produced at tennis, tennis-wise has never been higher or, in my opinion, a better content. How do you, as the sideline reporter, massage not offending the player again with getting good content that could, you don't want to say go viral, but that tennis fans will enjoy?
Yeah, I think it's just the balance of kind of my question formula is I ask a match question, I ask kind of a more general career question, and then from there, and again, if those two first questions lend themselves to a follow-up, I will certainly take that in whatever direction the player wants to take it in. But I think it's the third question and sometimes the fourth question, depending, that really is where you kind of uncover a bit of a player's personality. And again, I do get a lot of the juniors. The last half of the second week for me at the U.S. Open is a lot of junior players. I will tell you, I had Emilio Nava on my court three or four times over the past week. Huge, really, really big fan of his attitude on court. He was a boys finalist. He has already turned pro. He is the cousin of Ernesto Escobedo, which things that you learn when you're researching, you're researching the juniors. But a lot of times, you know, you can tell these juniors have never given a post-match interview in their lives. I'm fairly sure I did one of Sonia Kennan's first ever post-match interviews. I actually saw Amanda Anisimova in Newport this summer, and we were talking about that. I was one of her first as well, and both of them have improved leaps and bounds because it's not something that those 16, 17-year-olds are used to. Another young player I spoke to was Zach Spida. He won Kalamazoo and got a wild card into the main draw, almost beat Paolo Lorenzi in five sets. Really fun story. And we did, he again, 16 years old, and he has already turned pro. And we did a sit-down interview, and afterward he was like, you know, what could I have done better? What's the best way for me to approach these interviews? And I thought that was absolutely fantastic that he was asking those questions because, as you said, social media and the presence of a player in terms of their personality and what they project to the world actually earns money right these days. And so if you can learn how to do that well when you're young, for the players who are young, I mean, it's going to be a huge advantage for them when they get older. Some are never going to be great, but the fact that the young players are aware of this and are trying, I think is a huge plus.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at newbalance.com.
Did you say, so what's up, Spider-Man? Because I'm trying to get that to stick. I feel like that'd be a pretty good one.
I really like, don't let Brad Gilbert get a hold of that. He'll be all over that one.
No, that's right up his alley. Exactly. I live to serve. Behind every good comedian is a good Jewish comedy writer, and that's me. But that's a story for another. Yeah, that's a story for another time. You mentioned social media, and again, I said this at the get go, but. Yeah, if you're a fan of tennis social media, you have seen Blair Henley content somewhere on there. For tournaments moving forward and just for the game of tennis, we've seen a steady rise, but how important do you think the social media component will be in terms of covering and ultimately growing the game?
I mean, I think it's huge. It's obviously TV, I think, is still king, but when you see, you know, even U.S. Open now, that was in its first year this year, and I think they said they had over 5.5 million viewers throughout the 2 weeks. I think it is moving in the direction of digital and streaming and social and all of those things that, you know, have been taking over the world in recent years. But I think a perfect example is Sasha Zverev creating a Twitter account days after joining teammates. It is a moneymaker, and it is part of, I actually just recently finished a story not yet published for Tennis Magazine about the impact of social media over the past decade on tennis in particular. And I talked to Kelly Wolf, who is a longtime agent at Octagon, and she was saying that contracts are negotiated based on number of followers and ability to market and what demographics they're reaching via social media. So it is absolutely huge, and it's something, I mean, any young player, I think, I would hope that they're aware, and if they're not, I would hope their parents or their agents are aware. It's a huge part of the game now and of the marketability factor and the money factor. So it is, I think, it for better or worse, it is the way that it is these days.
If you think we at Cracked Rackets aren't waiting for the Blair Henley bump after this podcast, you're crazy.
Don't wait too long.
Yeah, that was, yeah, whatever. But for you, again, on that topic of social media, all week long you have all of these players coming and all of the opportunity to produce all of these clips for the tournaments. You go from tournament to tournament doing this sort of thing. How do you guys maintain, you know, keeping it fresh, maintaining new ideas? Because I can only imagine how difficult that is. The example I'll point to, Cam Norrie in Houston doing the different Big 12 schools. That was so – I was like, this is my content. I'm here for this.
Well, that makes me so happy. I loved it. I also went to Rice, so I went to a Texas school. So I had a vested interest in that particular video. But that one was so much fun. You're exactly right. It is so, so hard to keep things fresh. There, you know, that when I sit down and start brainstorming for whatever tournament is coming next, it is a challenge. And so sometimes, you know, in Cincinnati, for instance, it's a matter of taking something that's been done before, players in golf carts. We've seen that before, but we knew that we kind of wanted to make our version in Cincinnati it more of a carpool karaoke feel. And the fact that security, by the way, side note, security initially told me, absolutely not, you are not driving a player in a golf cart. And I heard that kind of from a secondhand source. It was from kind of their intermediary. And I said, well, would the security team consider meeting with me? And so I was like, you know, I'm not going to take no for an answer unless it's face-to-face. And so I sat down with the entire Cincinnati security team, and I said, listen, I totally understand your objective. I understand that you need to keep the player safe. I feel like this is, you know, it's a 2.5-minute drive. We're going to have a pace car up ahead. No chance to be on the road. I feel like we can do this and keep everyone safe. And they said, you know what? We're willing to let you give it a shot. And to their credit, again, it really, to have nobody else in the cart with us really did lend itself to a more conversational feel. And because usually, I mean, almost always, even if you don't see them on camera, there is a WTA PR person or an ATP PR team member right off camera. So there's always somebody kind of watching in the wings. And so kind of to be out there all by ourselves, I feel like gave the interview a different tone. So sometimes it's a matter of taking something that may have been done before and making it your own. But again, I think with Cam Norrie, if you can look at individual players and say, hey, he has a specific hook here. We're at a Houston tournament. People know TCU. Let's play off of this. So sometimes it's just a matter of looking at individual players and saying, okay, what can we do that would be fun based on this player's interests, off-court interests, things that they're known for on court or off court. So it's a combination, but it's definitely not easy.
Again, I had the chance to go to Cincinnati, and I was in the WhatsApp media group. I'll wait for the text next year to say, uh-oh, Blair's gone rogue, golf cart out of control. I'll be on the lookout for that one, because that course is right next to the stadium, so you could have gone rogue.
I could have gone rogue, and the irony in that entire segment and us making it happen was that on day one, I believe, yeah, I started on Friday, but Saturday before the tournament started, I'm leaving the hotel, and I have, there is a player and a coach waiting out there. I don't know if they missed their ride. Regardless, they did not have transportation there to take them to the site. They asked me if I was going to the site. I said, sure, come on. And so it ended up being Carlos, and is it Carlos Martinez, Svetlana Kuznetsova's coach?
I think so.
His last name is escaping me. He was in the front seat. A doubles player named Monaco was in the back seat. Anyway, long story short, we ended up having to take a detour. I'm already so flustered because they are late for their practice course. We took a wrong turn. Somebody directed me the wrong way. I end up getting pulled over. I get pulled over with Carlos in the front seat. He's like, I felt so bad. It could not have been worse. The cop then asked me to pull forward because he didn't like where I had pulled over. There was a landscaping rock immediately to my right that I could not see, end up doing several thousand dollars worth of damage to the running board of the car with a player and a coach in the car along with two other teammates of mine at the tournament. So, again, all well that ends well, no injuries other than my pride. But the fact that literally I was driving players alone in a golf cart 2 days after I had a speeding ticket and a damaged car with a player and a coach in the car. Again, a total tangent there, but the irony was high.
I think that's your next segment at a tournament, being in the car with players when you get pulled over and just have a video going the whole time and they're just like, oh no, what's going on? You have the cop bring Kuznetsova out of the car. That's a Fallon skit. We'll save that for another
time. Sweet Carlos, every time he saw me, he gave me this like look of sad pity. He was asking the people in the car when he saw that, how's she doing? How is she? Is she okay? So props to Carlos. And you know what? Svetlana ended up in the final. So again, all's well that ends well.
Sounds like a good omen to me. I love it. Well, then I do want to ask one more U.S. Open or sideline. I think that started as a sideline interview question. So sideline interview based question. There's always those moments where, you know, you get the winner that the crowd doesn't want. For you in particular, the moment I'm thinking of when Barty and Azarenka beat Coco and McNally at this U.S. Open. And just, I'm curious for you, how do you maneuver, you know, the rambunctious, or the crowd, or I guess not maneuver, but a crowd that maybe may not be as interested, how do you keep them engaged in a moment like that?
Yeah, that's a very astute question, because it wasn't a difficult post-match because Ash and Vika are so great, but you did want to address the fact that we were standing room only, three rows deep for a women's doubles match at the U.S. Open, which was absolutely incredible to witness. So I asked them a general question about the match, but I did want to acknowledge the fact that they were playing against two players who had made major headlines at the U.S. Open, because Katie obviously had, you know, was close, was one set away.
Set on Serena, yeah.
Yeah, and has had a great year of her own. So the question that I actually asked them was, you know, obviously we have two players on the other side of the court from you today who have done big things here in New York at just 17 and 15. When you were 17 and 15, or, you know, teenagers, what advice would you have given yourself knowing what you know now? And so that was kind of my way of tying in, acknowledging the fact that, yes, there were a lot of people there, yes, to see Ash and Vika, two incredible singles and doubles players, but also because of the buzz surrounding Katie and Coco. And so that was kind of my way of intertwining those two. But it was something that I definitely put thought into, because there was definitely so much excitement at the beginning, and it was just a case of youth versus experience, and experience dominated that day. So it can be tough, but I think it can be done.
Was Barty's answer like, I'd have played another year of cricket, to be honest. If I'd have known it was gone this well, you know, I can mess around a little longer, that sort of thing.
Yeah, no, they both, I mean, Ash is big on enjoying it. And you really just believe her. I mean, you obviously hear that answer from a lot of players. Make sure you're having fun. But with Ash, you really just believe her. And given her story, I think it comes from a very authentic place.
Yeah. Well, speaking of having fun, I do want to get into your background a little bit because it's so fun to watch you. It's obvious your love for the game of tennis. I mentioned earlier you are a former Rice All-Star college tennis player, but for you, a little embellishment. Now, you are an All-Star, all Conference USA Player of the Year is All-Star, right? I feel like I'm not crazy here. Yeah, exactly. Or I have an article from the Sun Sentinel from 1999. You really upset, I think it was the Boca team. You really knocked them out of that state title run. So, yes. But with that being said, how does, I believe it was Blair De Sissa at the time, I may have mispronounced that, find the game of tennis?
I was very lucky to have a father who is and was and still is a tennis pro. So I grew up at the tennis courts. He was at a club in New York in the winter. So actually in the summers growing up, I lived in Rye, which is a suburb of the city. So I had some US Open experiences when I was younger. And then in the winter and spring, he was in Florida. And so for the first, gosh, probably 16 years of my life, we moved twice a year, and I spent a lot of time at the tennis court. And there was, again, for me, I absolutely loved it, and I was also a bit of a head case. So, and anyone who coached me or knew me back then, a bit of they would edit that part out. But I was just really intense, and I wanted to be the best that I could be. And you know, I certainly wasn't the most gifted tennis player ever, but I wanted to squeeze every bit out of the talent and out of the hard work that I could put into the game, and just really, really loved it. And thankfully had parents who never put any pressure on me because they knew I put enough pressure on myself, because I certainly, growing up in South Florida for at least part of the year, saw a lot of junior players who didn't have that luxury, just had that incredible pressure placed on them from such a young age. Kids who were away from home at 10, 11, 12, living at academies, who are shuttled to these tournaments. So again, I had it easy in terms of it, as far as that goes, and loved tennis and still love tennis to this day and get to work in it. So, yeah.
Would you say the traveling you did then helps you for life on the road now?
Oh, absolutely. And not necessarily life on the road, but I think traveling and having to do a lot by myself when I was younger is just, it develops your maturity. I mean, I think some people might say that that playing a sport at a high level at a young age can actually stunt your development in some ways. And I think that could be true. It depends on the person. But I think traveling internationally and traveling by myself when I was young, I mean, I had friends who had never been on an airplane, and I was doing a lot of these things by myself. And I'm still grateful to this day that I had that opportunity, because I really do think you are able to see things that you wouldn't have otherwise seen. It creates discipline and just that maturity that I don't think I could have gotten any other way. So I think I would have been a much different person had I not played tennis, but all just sports in general. I think it just develops you in ways that it's hard to create in other areas of life.
And for you, was college tennis something you had always circled?
Yes. I knew that was what I wanted to do. I was kind of a late bloomer, though. As you mentioned, the one-handed backhand, I will tell you, between ages probably 9 and 15, people just hit high backhands to me all day long. And so, again, it took me a little bit longer. I also love to come to the net. So again, loved seeing what Taylor Townsend was doing at the U.S. Open. It just made me so happy. As somebody who had more of an old school style of play as well, it was just so satisfying to see her beating the best in the world, serving and volleying. Loved it. Thought it was great. But again, because I was a bit of a late bloomer, I was maybe not recruited my sophomore and junior year by the same schools that would have recruited me my senior year. Mm-hmm. And but again, by the senior year, a lot of things are already said and done. So for me, I had decided on Rice, and zero regrets. Loved the school, loved the people, loved playing for the team, and had, I don't know, just a lot of really great opportunities came from that. And you know, an economics degree is pretty nice too. We'll take it.
Not that
I'm using it today.
The economics of rapping on a sideline interview. It makes sense to me. It's a cost-benefit analysis. The opportunity cost of him not rapping, much, much worse than him. Yeah. So that's you. But it's the residential colleges at Rice that had you? You just love that way better than the frat system?
In hindsight, yes. I was glad I've known people who were in sororities who have thought it was the best thing ever. I have heard from other people that it's perhaps not the best thing ever. I think it just depends on the person. But with anybody who's played on a team or even, you know, played, was in the band or any kind of a group like that, I think you become the closest to your teammates. And I am actually going on a weekend trip with maybe 9 or 10 of my former teammates this fall. So we are still the closest of friends. And it's just such a gift to have that, not only when you're in school, but then you still have those friends for the rest of your life.
Yeah, and for your team, talking about college tennis, it's you've gotten to see so much of the tennis world, and it's so rare that you find opportunities for tennis to become a team sport. Having been around that college environment, how much did you enjoy the team aspect of it? And do you think, you know, there's world team tennis now, there's international equivalents as well that take place throughout the year. Do you think, you know, professional tennis will ultimately find, or do you think there is a place in professional tennis, I should say, for team tennis to become a significant part of it?
I think it's become a much bigger conversation in the last couple of years with Topman Cup being phased out and the rage that has spawned, rightfully so, because it was such a neat event. And I think the fact that you have the ATP Cup coming up, we're going to see what the revamped Davis Cup is going to look like. Obviously, Laver Cup has been, I think by most accounts, a massive success. World Team Tennis, I think, is so great in so many ways. Anybody who's witnessed it, I was lucky enough to play in one World Team Tennis match, perhaps the highlight of my short-lived tennis career. It is so much fun. And I think, again, I think it's the marketing of it and trying to get new people who may have never seen a tennis match before in their life could come to that and say, wow, this is way more fun than I thought. The same thing in college tennis. Obviously, Rice is so small, and so your friends is a lot of other athletes. And so having, you know, the baseball team, which their stadium was right next door to the tennis courts at the time, having them come over after a game, which, by the way, our match started before their game started and their game ended before our match ended. and having them come over and see us grinding it out and seeing how intense it was and how rowdy it was, that was so satisfying to me to have those guys saying, I had no idea it could be this much fun. And so that is my hope with these team competitions and the fact that there are now more of them. I do hope that Hopman Cup will resurface in some sort of revamped way. I think it certainly deserves that. And I think maybe people will appreciate it a little more, knowing that it, you know, has come and gone and hopefully come back again. So I think it's definitely in the consciousness now and the value of those team competitions and how much fun the players have with it. So I certainly hope, yes, I hope to answer your question. That was a very long-winded way to say, yes, I think there's a place for it. I think it's fun for fans and I think it's fun for players. And so it's just a matter of having the time of the year and the money, the financial factor. I mean, there are so many things that go into making those events work. And if lightning can strike and we can maybe have a co-ed version of that, I think it would be fantastic.
I completely agree with you. There is something intrinsic about team tennis. The college doubles point is as fun as any moment in tennis to have, you know, three matches wide. They're all going simultaneously. Everyone's pumping each other up. It's as fun as anything, in my opinion. But I'm glad you gave me the little nugget that the baseball field was next to the tennis courts, because I imagine in the crowds during your match, a young man who happened to be a pretty decent baseball player by the name of Tyler Henley starts in the crowd. He goes, "Oh, this Blair DeCessa, sorry if I pronounce it incorrect again, but she's quite the player. Is there a story there?"
It's funny. He is actually he's not quite 2 years younger than I am, but he was 2 years younger in school. And so I cue the cougar jokes, but I didn't know him as well, actually. And I didn't really get to know him until I was graduating, kind of my last few months of school. So he didn't see a whole lot of my tennis playing days. I just happened to it was proximity maybe, but we spent a lot of time around the baseball team, and they supported us and we supported them, and it was a lot of fun. But yes, perhaps that was my good wager of the fact that the baseball stadium happened to be right there. I'm sure that did not hurt in the eventual the coupling. It worked out. I never thought, certainly when we met, I was not thinking this is the person I'm going to marry. I was about to leave and study abroad for a semester, but it stood the test of time, and here we are, married for almost 11 years. So. Yeah.
And we talked about life on the road. I read a piece you wrote for ESPNW back in the day about what it's like, life on the road, when you're living with someone, close with someone who is a minor league baseball player, traveling from place to place. It's during that time that I believe the Blair Henley instructional videos on YouTube became a thing. Can you sort of talk about how those transpired? Because those videos are still, they've held up.
I am shocked, to be completely honest. When Tyler finished playing, he got injured and ended up going back to school at Rice in 2011. Soon after that, I started working for Tennis Now, which still has some, shout out to Chris Otto and Richard Pagliaro, who make Tennis Now tick. But they had a fairly significant YouTube following. And so we did biweekly tennis news shows for them, and that's kind of where I got my feet wet in front of the camera. And my boss at the time was like, we really need to add in some instruction content. And I was like, well, I could probably put something together. So I look back and I just cringe, because I didn't think anybody was going to watch them. And so had I known that, here we are, however many years later, that they still do get watched today, I probably would have put more into the actual production of things. Most of those were one take, and I did not even look at them before they were published. So again, word to the wise, if it's going anywhere on a public forum, you should probably check it out first, because you never know. But I will tell you that I'm joking mostly, but I have been just blown away by the response that I still get from those videos. I regularly have people come up to me at tournaments who say, oh my gosh, you helped me hit my forehand better, or I was able to teach my daughter how to hit a backhand because of you. This happens regularly, and I'm shocked every time, because I shot those so many years ago, but it makes me so happy to think that those videos have been helpful to people. For anyone who might go looking them up now, they're definitely more basic. They're not meant for players who are, going to go pro. But that's kind of how I learned. I learned a game that was a bit more classic and that stands the test of time. I was not hitting with a Western grip, which, again, nothing wrong with that. But sometimes if you have a junior who's just okay and learns grip like that, then, maybe they play in college. But at 30, 40, or, even 50, and for the rest of their lives, that style of play is probably not going to hold up quite as well. And so that was kind of my goal, was to kind of show people the way that I learned. And it's part of the reason I think that I still really love hitting and hit as much as I can these days. So I'm glad people watch them. I never would have thought in a million years that they would. So
I mean, everyone loves watching a one-handed backhand get attacked, right? So that's what it's all about. They're seriously the excellent instruction videos that have held up well, and obviously those initial camera reps worked out because you ended up in this, in the position of getting to do the sideline interviews, and I'm sure you get the question all the time, how do I get your job, Blair? It's the coolest job in the world, and it really is. You get to do some pretty cool stuff. But I'm curious for you, what is the piece of advice you give anyone who is interested in tennis media, or maybe not even tennis media, but sports media in general? What should they do to get into it?
There are two little tidbits. Again, I wish there was some magic formula, but I usually tell, because I have had some people, message me or say, can you give me any advice? And I really think starting at the tournament level can be hugely helpful. I know so many people who have started off as a press aide or working in the media room or doing some sort of player liaison type position at tournaments who have ended up working their way up from there. It really allows you access. In particular, like for instance, at a 250 event, like in Delray Beach, that was one of the first tournaments I ever covered. And it's so small that you can really see every aspect of kind of the inner workings of the event. So I would totally recommend trying to get a job at a tournament. And usually tournaments are so happy to have people who actually know tennis. it's a luxury. So I usually, if you're competent and a hard worker and you know the game, you should be able to find a position. And then I would also say, and this is something that I wished I had done better, start your online, I don't want to say persona, but I would develop your brand. It plays a role.
Spoken like an econ major.
Right. Start a Twitter account and start not necessarily commentating, but having opinions. And you can, these days, you can put your own stuff out. You don't need to be hired by someone to do that. So I think there are so many ways to kind of, again, develop your brand in that way to where when you do get that opportunity, when, say, you're working your way up at a tournament and somebody says, hey, we need to fill in on court tonight, you can show them, hey, look, I have some proof that I have been doing my homework here in the sport of tennis. So those are kind of the two things that I would point to as little things that you can do now that could help you later.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, with that in mind, there's one last thing I want to do, and you've been so kind with your time, but we like to have all of our guests run them through a little rapid fire segment. I can ask you, and it's more rapid fire in that I'm going to ask a lot of questions in a short period of time for you, as long as you want the answer to be, give it to us. Sound good?
Okay, great. I'm sweating. Okay, I'm ready.
All right, Westhoff, give me a rapid fire sound effect, please. Well, then the place we'll start. We'll start with an easy one. Favorite city in the world?
Queenstown, New Zealand.
Wow, that is obscure.
It's beautiful.
Yeah. Good. No, that's a very specific. I like your go-to meal.
I love Chewy's Mexican food. If you've ever been to a Chewy's, that's my favorite comfort food.
I love it. Well, when Blair Henley is not on a tennis court, she is
taking care of my kids. my other full-time job.
Yeah, of course. This isn't a rapid-fire answer, but I imagine it must be so difficult being on the road away from them for so long.
It is a challenge, and I am very thankful for supportive husbands, supportive in-laws, supportive parents. They're the best, and I could not do this without them.
That's awesome. Well, changing gears here. We talked a little college tennis, and I like to do this with anyone who played college tennis. You spend so much time with your teammates. In case that any of them are listening, I'm going to give you a chance to throw some of them under the bus. So while in college, your favorite practice partner?
Oh, favorite practice partner, probably Lauren Archer. She was a backboard for my first year. She transferred to Duke, but shout out to Lauren.
I love it. Your favorite to get dinner with?
Yasmin Carey, now Carey, then Fisher. Actually, funny story on the dinner. As a freshman, I was getting the credit card. The coach was giving me the credit card to pay for dinner. And we laugh about this now. I had a very, very fun team. And by fun, I mean they were wild and crazy. And I was perhaps the goody two-shoes of the bunch. And so I was in charge of a lot of our team dinners.
I like it. Well, then this is where we really get rambunctious. The teammate most likely to hook you in practice.
Oh, gosh. Probably Yazzie again. Same one. She's fun and anything went on the tennis court, that's for sure.
I love it. How about this? Best to go out with. Last one.
I got to give a shout out to the whole team. They were the absolute best. I came in as a wide-eyed 17-year-old on my recruiting trip. They gave me clothes to wear. I had never been more uncomfortable in my life, but they taught me. They taught me a lot, and they are. I mean, they're just the absolute best to say. Still, some of my best friends. So far, they're far more fun than I am, and hopefully they increase my stock in the fun department a little bit while I was there.
Look out for the Rice reunion in a couple of weekends. Apparently. Exactly. All right, how about this? The person you have not yet interviewed in tennis that you would like to interview the most?
I would love to get a one-on-one shot at Serena. I've asked her questions in press, but I've never been in a one-on-one setting with her. And I think it depends which Serena shows up that day. Sometimes she is verbose and sometimes she's not, but I'd be interested to kind of feel that situation out. I think it would be a challenge that I would welcome.
Well, with that in mind, under the premise that contractually you love every tournament equally, the tournament that you enjoy covering the most?
I love Newport will also always have a special place in my heart. If you haven't gone, you should. The grass, the museum, being part of history, being there for the induction every year, it is so special, and there are no night matches, and so you sleep a normal amount every night, and you get to enjoy the beautiful city of Newport, so it's really special. I love the fact that I get to be a part of just that whole experience every year.
Tennis Hall of Fame, underrated or overrated?
I would say underrated. I think more people should. I think more people should make the trip. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, I'm all in. The whole tennis hall, that's a bigger topic for another time. We can save that for another. But yeah, the tennis hall.
Happy to return.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm definitely going to take you up. Well, then my last one, and this isn't a rapid fire, but for all the tennis fans out there, and I know I'm speaking for all of them who are such fans of your work, what's the rest of 2019 look like for you? Where are we going to be able to find you?
That's a good question, and I don't really know the answer right now. I was thinking Hong Kong might have been a possibility, but unfortunately, it's looking like a lot of the protests and the violence that has been happening in Hong Kong has things. I'm not really sure how that's going to shake out, and I hope everything works out for them there because I've heard it is a fantastic tournament. But it might be a quiet fall for me, to be honest. The WTA finals moved to Shenzhen, and things have shifted a little bit there. I was lucky enough to be in Singapore last year, and I'm glad I got to get in on the tail end of that. But yeah, it might be a quiet fall, and who knows? I have some ideas that I'd love to develop a little more. I would love to. Yeah, well, I was gonna explain what I would like to develop, but perhaps I should test my cards a bit on that. There are certain things. I feel like there are opportunities in tennis that have not been necessarily taken in terms of exploring a player's personality, and I would love to maybe conceptualize a way to do that better. And so maybe the calm fall season will lend itself to other things in the future.
I'm not even kidding. I had a pencil in my hand and my notebook out. I was like, all right, what's she doing? And I was ready to write it down, and you caught me. No, but yeah, if anyone has deserved a little bit of a break, it is definitely you, Blair. Thank you so much again for taking the time. And with that free time, look, if you got things on your mind, you want to come chat, we would always love to have you on our Cracked Racquets podcast network.
Well, this was a pleasure, Alex. Thank you so much. This is the best way to kind of come down from the U.S. Open craziness, to kind of be able to talk tennis, in a controlled setting. Nobody, no people rushing around you. This is perfect. Thank you so much.
As you know, my opening text was hot, right? I was swooning, and I'm still swooning an hour later. So thank you so much. Yeah, and I look forward. Hopefully we get the chance to do this again soon.
Thanks so much.